Joe Vanover for Arizon. Good morning.
As you were saying.
As you were saying, there may be some of your prior argument that you don't want to review, but
yes,
you might have something else for us.
I'll try to move into new territory. I think Judge Stith mentioned on the legal sentence versus most of case law that says, a judgment comes final, you have to pursue certain remedies. One line or the other has to be overruled. I would completely agree. One line or the other has to be overruled. And I think it's the Osana line of cases that has to be overruled. Because under Osana, there's just no boundaries to win.
Yeah, that sounds a lot like Coram Nobis, which we don't have anymore. People challenging a conviction after they've served their sentence or never had their sentence imposed or executed because they've successfully completed probation. In the last case, it was suggested that somebody who has had their sentence, execution of their sentence suspended and is on probation could seek habeas. Are they in custody for purposes of habeas?
I think your fairly new decision on who can seek relief under habeas expands it to anyone that's on probation.
We've held that anyone on probation is still being held and since they have their freedom limited and therefore they're entitled to habeas.
And I'm not an expert on habeas, but that seems to be a large expansion of habeas law to allow people on probation to seek relief under habeas.
If
a person on probation could seek relief under habeas because their liberty is being restrained, a person that's off of probation is still having their liberty restrained by this conviction. A person that's
is that an issue you've raised in this case?
No, it's not an issue. The whole habeas, can they seek relief when they're still on probation? I don't think that's really.
And are you familiar with our cases concerning whether or not habeas is available when someone's on probation?
I'm not a scholar in that area, but I am aware of those.
So that we do have cases saying that they're being restrained while they're on probation.
Right. And my point is, if a person on probation is being restrained to some extent, a person with a conviction on the record is being restrained to some extent because they're not free to apply to be a high school.
Well, the analysis in those cases wouldn't apply to when they're off probation.
That's probably too big for me to take that big of a bite and try to get you to overturn those cases in this one.
What I'm trying to explore is to make sure that those who are entitled to relief have a remedy, but that nobody has duplicative remedies.
Yes.
So if somebody in the position of these defendants, the defendant in this case and the prior case, has the remedy of 2907, do we need to say, or is it correct to say, that they also have some sort of inchoate habeas remedy available to them as well? Why is it 2907 sufficient?
Well, I think 2907 should be sufficient under the first clause for defendants on SIS probation, under the second clause for SES probation. But then, once a person is delivered to the Department of Corrections...
Well, then they have their PCR, and that ought to be sufficient.
That's 24035. They shift from 2907. Once you go to the Department of Corrections, you shift into 24035, and you have those remedies.
But the case law says that habeas is also available as long as they meet the criteria for habeas. That it's... You do the analysis of cause and prejudice and jurisdictional or lack of authority so that the cases give both the post-conviction remedy and habeas under certain circumstances.
Yes, and I think habeas is kind of used in that position of years later you can still file a petition for writ of habeas corpus.
So if we found that there was only post-conviction remedy available, we'd have to overturn all those cases that say there is, in fact, habeas in addition if you meet the criteria for habeas.
Correct. I think that habeas, 2907D is available for people that haven't gone to the Department of Corrections, right. The one that have, 24035. The people that are just completely out of the system, habeas is a possibility. But on a habeas, and I think on a 2907D, if this case were to be sent back to the sentencing court and the 2912 motion was overruled and the defendant asked for relief under 2907D, one of the elements is the court has to find that there was manifest injustice in sentencing him to more than 1 year. Usually manifest injustice on a sentence in excess of the statutory maximum is pretty straightforward. if it's a felony DWI, you've been sentenced, like in the Turner case, you were sentenced to 3 years, but one of the priors doesn't count, so it's only a misdemeanor. That's manifest injustice that someone is being held beyond the statutory maximum. On these facts, on the Basil cases, it's felony stealing. At the same time that the felony stealing statute was out there, there was a felony receiving stolen property statute that was the same penalty range. And I think it's impossible for someone to commit a felony stealing without also committing felony receiving stolen property. So is it manifest injustice for someone to be convicted basically under the wrong name of a statute? What they have done fits two different statutes. Is it unjust to say we're going to leave you with a conviction on felony stealing if what they actually did was felony receiving stolen property? And I don't think so.
Well, but that's not the charge that they were. That's not even the crime. Forget the level of punishment associated with it, with which they were charged.
They were charged under one statute.
And I'm not sure, opposing counsel suggests, you would not be allowed in the ordinary course to have amended from stealing to receiving if the charge of receiving was out of time. Is that correct?
I know that's what his argument is. I would disagree that on whether we could, an amendment would be proper.
Well, can you amend to an entirely different charge?
I believe an amendment from felony from stealing to receiving is appropriate.
Why would that be appropriate and not second-degree murder?
Receiving stolen property is an included offense of stealing. Stealing is taking without permission. Receiving is retaining possession of, knowing that it's been stolen.
Is it officially a lesser-included offense, or you just think the same facts would prove it?
Yeah, they just practically overlapping.
I don't think I cited any cases that says it's an included offense. But practically speaking, a person who takes without permission also retains possession of, knowing that it has been stolen.
Often or always? I mean, as a matter of law or just as a matter of...
I think as a matter of law and as a matter of logic. I can't think of any circumstance where a person is guilty of stealing and not guilty of receiving stolen property. Because receiving stolen property includes retaining possession of and disposing of. If someone if I walk out the door with this, as soon as I take this, I am then guilty of receiving stolen property because I am retaining possession of something that I know has been stolen. So I think that's where there's no manifest injustice, if we get that far, on these cases. And that probably applies to habeas actions, too.
Have cases held that?
I don't believe so.
I mean, have they held that you're guilty of retaining if you steal because as soon as you walk out the door with it, you've retained it?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
But I think as a matter of logic, a person that takes without permission at that moment retains possession of until they dispose of it, knowing that it has been
stolen. So you can say I didn't steal it, I just received it?
What'd you say?
So you can say I didn't steal this from somebody, I just received their wallet?
And that happens. In charging decisions, that happens quite a bit. Well, if the prosecution can't prove that the defendant took the item, but
sure,
he was caught with the stolen
right
item, he'll be
sure
charged with receiving stolen property.
Absolutely.
When there's a strong suspicion that he stole it, but there's not quite enough proof, but there is absolute proof that he had possession of it, knowing that it was stolen.
Can you be charged with both?
I don't think you can be charged with both.
Why not?
Because I think it's an included offense. And I think you cannot charge included offenses together unless there's explicit language in the statute that says that you can. That goes back to, I think, Missouri versus Hunter on the armed criminal action cases, where it said armed criminal action specifically by statute says it can be charged in addition to the crime. But I don't think that there's that specific language in the
It would be statute. Double jeopardy under Hunter unless there was a specific intent by the legislature
right
to make it two crimes.
Yes.
Counsel, just real quickly, getting you back to this Walker case that we have in front of us now.
Yes.
Is there anything different in the facts between Mr. Walker and the previous case you argued, Mr. Nelson? I mean, they both got SESs and they both were placed on probation, and I assume neither one served any time?
Mr. Walker, when he got his, received his the grant of the 2912 motion, he was sentenced to 1 year in the county jail, which meant he spent 5 or 6 more months in jail after the judgment was changed from a felony to a misdemeanor.
And that distinction in facts really doesn't change the legal argument you're making?
I don't think it changed the legal argument. I think one opinion could cover both cases, basically.
In looking at the sentence, judgment, and commitment executed by Judge Fincham in March of this year, it says that he is to serve 1 year in jail. Is he serving 1 year in jail for the felony of stealing, which is what he was charged with, versus a Class A misdemeanor? Because the sentence and judgment doesn't reference it's a misdemeanor judgment.
I am not certain on that. I know that he did go to jail, and he did file multiple motions from jail complaining.
But it
about
could have significant consequences to him as to whether he served a year in jail for a misdemeanor stealing offense versus a felony stealing offense.
Well, the order from Judge Fincham, I think, was he granted the 2912 motion. So,
well, I'm looking at the sentence, and I don't see where it says that on the sentence, judgment, and commitment. It just says he appears in person, charge having been read, enters a plea of guilty. So it doesn't cite, unless there's an additional judgment, it doesn't cite all the circumstances of this case. It simply says to serve a year in jail and pay costs.
And if the record is incomplete, I can't really speak to that.
I'm looking at your Appendix 10, if you have a chance to look at that before you come up for rebuttal.
I will. Thank you.
Thank you.
Please, the Court.
Mr. John, there was no separate plea proceeding following the filing of your motion, was there?
No, there wasn't. The judge just entered a new judgment and sentence, reducing the degree of, well, I thought to reducing the degree of offense. I guess I need to look at
the
sentence.
Because he entered a plea of guilty to a felony. And so the court didn't say he's no longer guilty of a felony. It just ordered a one-year sentence. So the question is, does your client still have a felony? Based on Judge Fincham's judgment, does he still have a felony conviction?
I'd have to look at it. He shouldn't have a felony conviction because it's only a misdemeanor. That was the whole basis behind the resentencing. So the judgment should reflect a misdemeanor, in my opinion. As far as the prosecutor has brought up that Judge under 2907 still has to make a determination of a manifest injustice. The judge has already found a manifest injustice. When granted the 2912B motion, the judge specifically, the judge found that there was a manifest injustice. And in the Missouri, this court's case law is specific that if you have a sentence in excess, of course it's a manifest injustice. So I don't think that's
an
issue.
Those cases are on direct appeal, though. Aren't they?
Those were on direct appeal, but I still think that any time, I think you'd be hard-pressed to say that a sentence in excess of what's authorized by the statute would not be a manifest injustice. I cannot see where there would be more of a manifest injustice than an excessive sentence.
So, and I'll grill you like I grilled the last lawyer on this issue. So my concern is so you could hold back. And you wouldn't have to bring it on a direct appeal. You wouldn't have to bring it on a 24035. You could just wait until later down the road till you wanted to bring that action. And so you think that's valid, and the issue that you could have raised it earlier shouldn't play into the discussion of whether or not there was manifest injustice?
Well, I'm not sure he could have raised it earlier. I mean,
why
right
not?
Now,
if it was
only
clear and unambiguous, it could have been raised.
But
in fact, you raised it earlier in Tasley.
I did. In the directed, after he pled guilty, he had a limited direct appeal issue. The only issues on direct appeal that this court has said you can raise is subject matter jurisdiction, or lack of it, and an information that doesn't charge an offense. I'm not sure that really fits this.
And Pasley told you couldn't raise it, too.
Right, and Pasley told you couldn't. And in any event, 24035 contemplates that you don't have to appeal it. So I don't think he's waived anything. I mean, I think...
I'm not saying he waived. I'm just saying that should the fact that it wasn't brought earlier and could have been brought earlier play into the analysis of whether or not there was manifest injustice?
I don't think so, because he still is serving it. I think the parties in the court could get together, and if they agreed to an excessive sentence, you can't do that. I mean, all parties couldn't combine saying, okay, the maximum sentence here is 7 years, but we'll agree to a 10. I think the case law is clear that you can't agree to something that's legally impossible.
In this case, though, when it is a ruling, and depending on how the court decides, whether it's a clarification or new law, if the court decides it's new law and it does not have retroactive application, that ruling would be for naught. If you're saying it's always manifest injustice, so you'd be able to get relief for it even if it's not retroactively applied.
Well, again, I don't think retroactivity is an issue here because he still has the right to proceed.
I know. I'm talking broader than this.
Right. I mean, I still think you can have a... I think the U.S. Supreme Court cases have situations where even if there's a manifest injustice, there's still procedural hurdles that you have to overcome and things like that.
And if it's not retroactively applied, then there is no manifest injustice. Because
well, there may be a manifest injustice, but you may not be able to raise it.
Thank you.
I think there still would be a manifest injustice. I do think that 2907 and habeas can work together. I mean, I don't think they're coextensive. And let's say we have a situation like here where you don't have the defendant sent to the Department of Corrections, which is easy to 24035. There is the 2907, but not all claims go to the actual guilty plea. Some habeas only go to the sentence. And therefore, if you are only attacking the sentence, then a 2907D motion would not be appropriate to set aside the guilty plea. Actually, a habeas would be more appropriate. So I don't think that they're inconsistent. I think it depends on the issues.
It sounds like you think they're consistent, but you're saying 2907 wouldn't apply here. Only habeas would, because you're not challenging the conviction, only the sentence.
No. I'm saying we could do it 29. There's a manifest injustice. The court could find that the guilty plea is involuntary because they pled guilty to the facing the wrong punishment and could find a manifest injustice. But I'm saying that you wouldn't have to go into 2907D. If your only complaint is to the sentence, you actually aren't trying to set aside the guilty plea. You're trying to vacate the sentence, in which case then the habeas would apply. And sometimes that actually is beneficial to the state because if, let's say, you plead guilty and years later all the witnesses die, but the only thing that's wrong is the sentence. Well, actually, that may end up putting the state in an unfair advantage of now having to prosecute an offense it may not be able to prosecute anymore when the only error was as to the sentence.
In this case, that is a hypothetical because here the significance is the plea of guilty was to a felony offense when the felony offense was not available.
Right. That's true. I'm just saying that they're not mutually exclusive remedies, that it's not... that once 2907
fills in some cracks, but not all of them.
Right, and habeas fills in cracks both before and after a 24035. In this case, I mean, I think the court could have granted a habeas because under 9106, it says if the court has any evidence from any judicial proceeding, which this was, that any such person is illegally restrained of liberty, which they both were, then it's the duty of the court to issue a writ of habeas corpus for the person's relief, although the person didn't present such a writ. And so what the court did is exactly what the court could have done if the court had cited 9106. And I don't know that there's a requirement normally, I think, like on appeal, if the judge comes to the right result, but for a wrong reason.
Who's the respondent in that writ?
I'm sorry.
If this had been converted to a habeas or brought as a habeas initially, who would be the respondent? Who are you ordering to discharge the prison?
Well, that would be the judge who has the restraining the person
so
on
I bring,
felony probation.
I named the judge I'm in front of as the respondent? That seems odd.
Well, but the judge would be the one who's restraining the liberty through the probation.
Because they're not in prison at this point.
Right, because they're not in prison, so that in theory that would be.
As I recall, I may not have agreed in the case, but I think the petition for habeas was amended to name the Department of Corrections because they were supervising a parole.
Right. Parole is different, right, in which case you would do the Department of Corrections, which the office is located here in Jeff City, so that's...
You're saying the corollary is that probation, even though it's not supervised by the judge is the custodian?
I would think so, because technically the judge is the one who's supervising, is restraining the petitioner, is... giving conditions of probations and other things. So I really haven't seen any cases, so I don't know. I'm kind of thinking this through. But in any event, that it would seem to be applied because I don't know who else would be restrained. The judge is the one who's put him on probation. The judge is the one who is supervising. The judge is the one who's giving conditions of probation that is restraining the person's liberty. So that would appear to be the person that would apply.
First, as to Mr. Walker, the judgment that was filed March 2nd, 2017, A10 on the appendix at the top, it says charge, it lists the charge code, it says theft, stealing, and it says class A misdemeanor. So I believe the records would show that Mr. Walker
was sentenced. I missed that.
On misdemeanor. Next, there's a more basic point that we haven't spent much time on is 2912, does it give a sentencing court authority to take action? And there was a significant part of my brief that recited almost 20 years of case law that says 2912 does not give a court authority to grant relief. That hasn't really been debated here so much this morning.
Are there specific cases that say that you can't bring an independent action?
Yes. 2912? There's Doss, Hayden, quite a few. There's several, maybe 10 or so over the years.
So when would 2912 could ever be used?
2912 is an interesting rule. If it can't be used, why have it?
How about a motion for new trial arguing points that weren't preserved at trial? Why wouldn't that be? Why wouldn't 2912 be addressing the scope of that review?
Maybe that's the point of Rule 2912. Maybe that's why it's there. But if there is an argument that 2912 has to mean something, I would just say sometimes there's written law that you see it on the page, everyone thinks it means something, but it really doesn't. One example is the third subsection of the stealing statute that lists stealing a gun, stealing a car, stealing a controlled substance, stealing more than $500, which the legislature
has no meaning at all.
Has no meaning at all. And the legislature added to it over the years. It wasn't just like put in place. They added to it. The legislature and the governor, the executive branch and the legislative branch both had to have thought this meant something because they changed it. But as it stands right now, it's meaningless. So possibly 2912 is equally meaningless.
If the court accepts your position and there is no relief available under 2912, does the court have the ability to proceed with habeas because the court would have before it circumstances and information that would indicate an illegal sentence and manifest injustice?
If the defendant filed a habeas action.
Well, the habeas rule doesn't require the defendant to file the proceeding. The rule clearly makes it an obligation of the court to act if it finds that the circumstances outlined in Rule 91 apply.
I don't think I have a good answer for that, Judge.
When 9106 was adopted, did habeas only apply to those people who were actually in physical custody?
I think that might be the case. I see my time is up. Thank you.